That's what Colossians is about, the reconciler of all things, little and big and little, and all mixed together. And so that's kind of nice. I had some second thoughts about working with Colossians today because I started fooling around with Hebrews, and I got all excited about that, and I was going to change that. I'm glad I didn't. So we're going to look at Colossians. We're doing looking at New Testament portraits of Jesus. What we have in the New Testament is not a single vision of Jesus, but what we have is a portrait gallery, and each one of these witnesses paints his own picture. And it would be a terrible mistake to go through and ask which is the right one and throw all the others out. It would be a terrible mistake to try to superimpose one on another and make some kind of composite portrait. We'd miss the peculiarities, the particularities of each portrait. It would be a mistake to think that there could be an infinite number of portraits. We have a selected number. There's variety, there's diversity, but the diversity is finite. Jesus isn't just any old thing, but we can look at him in different ways. On Monday we looked at John's Gospel. John has a particular way of talking about Jesus, and we tried to get at that by looking at what his own summation of what he's doing. Jesus did many signs, but these are written that you may believe that he's the Christ, the Son of the living God, and that believing you may have life in his name. And so we tried to get at John under the rubric of the giver of life. That is John's portrait of Jesus. So today we go to Colossians, where the portrait is of a Jesus who is the reconciler of all things. Because this is the Word of God, we take it seriously. Because these are historical documents, we take that historicity, that historical character of the document seriously, and so we have to ask some basic questions about the document. To whom was it written? It's going to make some difference when we read Corinthians, what kind of a place Corinth was. And that's true of Ephesus and Philippi and Rome and all the rest. It's also true of Colossae. In chapter 4, verse 11, the text mentions, 4:13, the text mentions Colossae together with Laodicea and Hierapolis, and those three towns. Pardon me?
Chapter 4, verse 13.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, well, two things.
Okay. Colossae, Laodicea, and Hierapolis, and these three towns formed a little triangle, each about 10 miles from the other, about 100 miles inland from Ephesus, which is now in Turkey. And those towns were founded by Greeks from the mainland about 700 B.C. That area was conquered by the Romans in the 2nd century B.C., but they remained a group of people who were very self-conscious about their Greek heritage. There were a few Jews there, but not very many. You have a very different kind of situation than, for instance, in Galatia, where you have a heavy Jewish population. In Colossae, and it would also be true of Laodicea and Hierapolis, you have a heavy Greek concentration. People who are very conscious of their heritage, very conscious of their culture. They were believers in Jesus, but they had it all mixed up with that particular background, and that's going to be important as we look at the document. Who is the author of Colossians? It says the letter of Paul to the Colossians, and that's fine, but prior to copyright laws and royalties and all those kinds of things, People didn't worry anywhere near as much about authorship as we do, and so a lot of things were written under the name of other people, and so we always have to ask about authorship, and people have asked a lot about the authorship of Colossians. And there are a lot of people who have said that Paul simply could not have written this particular document. There are a number of reasons for that. There are tight little grammatical reasons. The little preposition for instance, occurs 36 times in Galatians, 300 times in Romans, and 1 and 2 Corinthians. It's a very Pauline preposition. It occurs only 5 times in Colossians. That's just an example of all kinds of things like that. You can analyze the grammar, the structure of the sentences, and come to the conclusion Paul couldn't have written this. There are people who see in this document a development of a particular Christian heresy, we're going to have to talk about that, Gnosticism, that they say could not have happened as early as Paul. Therefore, Paul couldn't have written it. There are also people who have decided that Paul is the Paul of Romans and Galatians. Particularly Lutherans tend to do this. Who is Paul? Paul is justification by grace alone through faith. Romans and Galatians. You go to any Lutheran seminary, get the catalog, look at the curriculum, and you're going to find Romans and or Galatians there. I think we're down to one or the other now, but for many years, students at Luther Seminary got Romans and Galatians. We don't care what else they get. I don't know anything else. We have to know Romans and Galatians. Well, if you start there, decide that's who Paul is, then you go to Colossians, a lot of the big Pauline terms simply don't occur. The word righteous does not occur in Colossians. The righteousness of God, the righteous, it's not there. Revelation is not there. The verb form of to judge is not in Colossians. Obedience, think of the obedience of faith, big Pauline category, it's not there. Salvation, are you saved? Just the word isn't in there. It's not there. There are people, C.A. Anderson Scott, for instance, I think Archibald Hunter also, who say that the center of Pauline theology is salvation, past, present, and future. That's the key to the whole Pauline thing, salvation. The word does not occur in Colossians. Fellowship, koinonia, does not occur in Colossians. Law does not occur in Colossians. Can you imagine that? Lutherans are Pauline people. And we all know that the whole universe, and particularly Christianity, can be organized under the rubrics of law and gospel. Everything fits into one of those pockets. The word law doesn't even occur in Colossians, nowhere. The verb to believe doesn't occur in Colossians. The just shall live by faith, by grace through faith. The word doesn't occur in Colossians. So you can come to the conclusion, obviously, Paul couldn't have written this document. I don't think we have to settle that question, but I should like to, I think Paul did write it, and I should like to say, that doesn't settle it, that's just expressing an opinion, that it is disaster if we approach the New Testament document with a single vision. Paul is a working missionary, for goodness sake. He's not sitting at his desk wondering what cute thing he can say about God today. He's a working missionary. He's out there proclaiming the gospel, and people respond. A congregation starts. He says, okay, bye-bye, see you later, and he goes off and starts another one. And these are letters. They're letters to very specific kinds of people, very specific congregations. And Paul doesn't write in thin air. He writes to those people. And Colossae is not Philippi, and Philippi is not Ephesus, and Ephesus is not Rome. So he always preaches Christ, but he preaches Christ to specific situations. And the situation in Colossae is such that he doesn't have to haul out all that artillery about law and righteousness. It's a different kind of situation. Okay? We could talk about from where it is written. It's one of the prison epistles. There are references in chapter 4, verses 3, 10, and 18, which make it clear that Paul, if he's the author, I think he is in prison. Traditionally, he's in Rome. The Roman imprisonment is in Acts 28. Acts 23 also talks about an imprisonment in Caesarea. There's extra-biblical evidence for Paul being in prison at one time or another in Ephesus. And the fact of the matter is we don't really know. It's a nice detective story to try to figure that out, but we're not going to worry about that right now. The date of the letter is also somewhat uncertain, but around the year 60 AD. Okay? If it's true, and if you don't think it is, I'll be glad to argue it with you. If it's true that Paul is a working missionary, that he's not talking to thin air, but he's talking to a specific concrete situation, then we always have to ask in these letters, what's the problem? Why the letter? He's not just saying, having a good time, wish you were here. He's responding to some problems, responding to an issue. You always have to ask, what is the problem to which the letter is addressed? And in Colossae, the problem is Gnosticism, and that is a very big word, and it is defined by different people in different ways, and it is a word that covers a whole cluster of phenomena in the first century. Let me try to give you a way of thinking about Gnosticism that is at least graspable, and I think that will open up this letter a little bit. Gnosticism is a view of God and the world which, by definition, separates God from the world. The word Gnosticism comes from a Greek verb, ginosko, which means to know. It does not mean to know intellectually. It means to know by getting in on the secret password. It has to do with the whole phenomenon of mystery religions. It says that God is far away. God is distant. God is separated from common life. God is way out there. God is the great unknown. That's what Gnosticism says. There's a Gnostic bookstore in Minneapolis. You may come across that term. Together with the whole mix of East and West, the invasion of this country by Eastern religions, there is a rebirth of Gnosticism. So you're going to come across that. In Colossae, these people had Gnosticism and Christianity all mixed up with one another. If you say, do you believe in Jesus? They say, oh yeah, we believe in Jesus. Well, then you talk with them for a while, and you find out that they have poured him through a Gnostic sieve, and everything comes out a little bit different. So Gnosticism is a first century heresy. If God is by definition separate from common things, if God is by definition distant, away, far out, then if you're interested in God, you have to figure out some way to get to him, some way to make connection with him. And so you build ladders.
from yourself to God. You build ladders from the world to God. And those ladders may be moral ladders, people who get the secret of the right things to do, rung by rung, they can climb to God. You may do it by ecstasy. If God is far distant, if God is spirit, the whole world of matter is separated from God, what you have to do then is to get out of the body and into the soul and let the soul climb rung by rung up to be with the great spirit up there. You may do it by you may do it by navel gazing. You may also do it by having a vision, by somehow or another leaving your body and having a great vision of God and his spirit and an experience with him which is distant. You can do it by all kinds of things. You may do it by getting in with your little secret society and saying, if you eat this particular kind of food, you know, you get a little prune whip and add a little paprika there, that puts you in contact with God, or special kinds of drinks. Or you may say that there are auspicious occasions when you can get in touch with God. Not on a common, ordinary day, but when the moon is just right, or when the stars are just right, there's an auspicious moment, and then, you can make contact with God if you say abacadabra in the right way at the right time. So the big problem is that God is distant, and how do you make contact with him? You can make contact with him in various ways. Okay, this is what was going on in Colossae, and it's evident in all kinds of places, but it's particularly clear in the second chapter. We just look a little bit at some of those things. In chapter 2, verse 8, Paul says, "See to it that no one makes a prey to you by philosophy." That's not philosophy in general. He's not saying don't read Kierkegaard, for goodness sakes. He's talking about a specific, everything is specific, everything is concrete in the New Testament, a specific philosophy, namely Gnosticism, empty deceit, according to human tradition. That's not against tradition. The whole Christian church is built on tradition. Tradition means to pass on from one to another. He's talking about Gnosticism, human tradition. According to the elemental spirits of the universe, the Gnostics had the whole universe peopled with all kinds of semi-divine, semi-human beings. I think, doesn't Lovejoy have a book entitled The Great Chain of Being? He's not talking about Gnosticism, but that's the same thing going on, that you have the earth where you have matter, but then the next rung up is beings that are 95% matter and 5% spirit. The next rung up is 90% matter, 10% spirit. You've got the angels in there, all kinds of, you know, semi-divine, semi-human stuff, and you get toward the top, and you've got 95% spirit, 5% matter, and so there are the elemental spirits of the universe. And if you can somehow get in touch with those spirits, if you can somehow make contact with them, you can climb your way rung by rung up to pure spirit, which is God. Paul says, don't monkey around with that garbage. Chapter 2, verse 16, therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in question of food and drink, special kinds of food and drink, put you in contact, or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. There are special, holy, auspicious times. There are common times. You can't get in touch with God through the common, only through the uncommon. Paul says, don't let those birds mess your life with Christ up and tell you that you're not doing it right because you're not doing their particular thing. These are a shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Tremendously interesting, Paul's, to me anyway, tremendously interesting, Paul's use, his appropriation, his co-opting of language and thought forms in order to make contact with people, but he takes those thought forms and twists them around for his own use, and it turns into a new thing. These words, shadow and substance, are right smack out of Plato. They are basic Platonic categories, and of course for Plato, who was essentially a Gnostic in different guise, what we see with our eyes and touch with our hands are only a shadow of the substance, the real stuff, which is in heaven and which is pure spirit. This particular dog, chaos, is not very important. What is real is not chaos, but is what is real is dogness, the idea of godness. And so those are Platonic words, but Paul takes those words, shadow and substance, and he throws them not into a spatial framework, but into a temporal framework, and he says those things are a shadow, not of something above, but of what is to come. The substance belongs to Christ. So he takes those categories that the Gnostics are using, for one thing, and he twists them around and makes them come out in terms of the old and the new, in terms of Christ. Let no one disqualify you. Don't let these birds come around and tell you you're not Christians or you're not good enough Christians. Don't let them do that. Insisting on self-abasement, worship of angels, of course, taking your stand on visions. These people are coming around and say, "Wow, I had a great vision last night. Oh, boy. I mean, you don't know anything about God if you haven't had a vision like I've had." Paul says, nonsense. Don't let them do that. Puffed up without reason by a sensuous mind, not holding fast to the head from whom the whole body nourished and linked, etc. Verse 20, if with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the universe, why do you live as though you still belong to the world? Who's worldly here? Paul, again, takes that. So he says, the people who are living in that Gnostic business, who are making up rules about what to eat and when to eat it, who are standing on visions, they're the worldly people. How do you like that? Why do you submit to regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. Moral legalism or spiritual legalism or ecstatic legalism or charismatic legalism, it's all the same business. Don't let them do that to you. These have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting rigor of devotion and self-abasement. Sounds good, but as a matter of fact, no value whatsoever in checking the indulgence of the flesh. Okay? The problem in Corinth is Gnosticism. They believed in Jesus, but they messed it up by pouring it through that Gnostic sieve. Okay, that's the problem. What does Paul do? Paul proclaims to them Jesus Christ. I happen to think that that the Christian faith is defensible. Not everybody thinks that. I happen to think it's defensible. I don't think it needs defending, but I think it's defensible. I think the Christian faith can be argued persuasively. And Paul does that in some places. In Romans, he has a very nice, tight argument against moralistic legalism. He can do that. But in this letter, he really doesn't argue. What he does is proclaim. He proclaims Jesus Christ. But he proclaims him in a way that matches the situation to whom he proclaims. Again, he never proclaims Christ in thin air. It's always specific. And it's throughout the letter, but the place where he really gets cooking is 1:15 through 20, and I think it's one of the great, great passages in the New Testament. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for in him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. Oh, man, isn't that something? There are different kinds of literature in the Bible, and one has to pay some attention to what kind of literature one is reading. So we have poetry. You can call it myth if you understand what myth means, but if that's a bad word, call it poetry. There's poetry in the Bible. There's historical narrative. If you read historical narrative as though it's poetry, you get in trouble. If you read poetry as though it's historical narrative, you get in trouble. The book of Revelation, Ezekiel, Mark 13, that's apocalyptic literature. That's a special genre of literature. You can't read that as historical narrative or as pre-written history or as poetry. It's apocalyptic. It's a special kind of literature. So you always have to ask that question. And 1:15 through 20 is a special kind of literature. I should call it a liturgical, confessional, doxological piece of stuff. there are a considerable number of people who have accepted the Pauline authorship of Colossians, but who have said that 1:15 through 20 wasn't written by Paul. H.J. Holtzman, University of Tübingen, some years ago, wrote a commentary on Colossians and omitted 15 through 20. there are those who have said that it was an early hymn. People do that with 1 Corinthians 13, too. I don't think so. 1 Corinthians 13 fits right between 12 and 14, and 1:15 through 20 is of the very essence of this letter to the Colossians. But it is a kind of a confessional, liturgical, doxological piece, and you really have to just kind of inhale it all at once. You have to kind of stand in it. You have to let it pour over you like standing in the rain. You have to take it in with one gulp. If you take it apart too much, you kind of miss it. What you have to hear is the drumbeat of that all things, all things, all things, all things, all things. These people in Colossae were making of Jesus a partial thing. They were Jesus and people. Jesus and my beautiful vision. Jesus and my dream last night. Jesus and my morality. Jesus and my special kind of food. Jesus and my password. They were Jesus and people. They made of Christ something partial. He was divine, yes. But he was one of those rungs on the ladder, way up at the top, but one of the rungs. 99% divine, 1% human something. A super angel they made of Jesus. Partiality. Paul says, all, everything is Jesus. So when you read it, it's kind of like, in the liturgy, therefore, with angels and archangels and all the company of heaven, we laud and magnify thy glorious name. Oh, boy, I fly. I hope you do, too. But don't ask me too much about angels and archangels. You kind of have to just take that in with a gulp. So, in a way, to dissect that thing is not only pretentious, but it's a little bit dangerous, but we're going to do a little bit of that anyway, because obviously the words and the phrases are important. It isn't just incantation.
Let's look at it for a minute. He is the image of the invisible God. Said last week or the week before that it makes a lot of difference what you underline when you read the Bible. Work out your own salvation in fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you. Now, what half do you underline? It makes a lot of difference. I should say that the Gnostics here, and maybe a lot of us, underline invisible. He's the image of the invisible God. God is invisible. That's the big thing about God. You can't see him. You can't know him. He's way out there. That's not the point. What you underline is image. He is the image of the invisible God. Of course, God is invisible, but that's not the big deal. The big deal is that he's made himself known in Jesus Christ. In Jesus Christ, we see God. We touch God. We feel God. We smell God. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. That little phrase has caused a lot of trouble in the church. Arius, in the early centuries of the church, loved this passage. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. That little phrase has caused a lot of trouble in the church. Arius, in the early centuries of the church, loved this passage. He said that Jesus Christ was divine, he was God, but he was not equal with God. And he had a little phrase, there was a time when he was not. That meant that Jesus is God, he's divine, but there was a time when he was not. That is, he is one of the created beings. He's one of the rungs on the ladder. And that wouldn't have been so bad, except that Arius had a guitar, and he wrote a lot of songs about that. And a lot of people picked that up, and all over the Mediterranean world, they're saying, there was a time when he was not. And so that became a big problem. That's true. I make up a lot of stuff. I didn't make up that. And so Constantine called a council at Nicaea, and there was a big fight there. And through many years, Nicaea to Constantinople, we get the Nicene Creed, huh? And every phrase in that Nicene Creed, very God of very God, begotten, not made, begotten, but not made, being of one substance with the Father. Every one of those phrases in the Nicene Creed is very specific, very particular, very concrete, and it's aimed at Arius and all of his friends, some of whom were the Gnostics at Colossae, not direct friends, but of the same stripe. The word firstborn is not a temporal term, but is a term of preeminence. And what that means is that Jesus Christ is preeminent in all creation. There's nothing that can touch him. He is the one in whom all things hold together. The firstborn of all creation. It's an unfortunate translation, actually, in the RSV.
New English calls it the primacy.
Great. Very nice. Perfect. The primacy, what is the phrase?
His is the primacy over all created.
His is the primacy over all created things. Beautiful. Prototicus. That's what it should read. Okay? For in him all things were created.
We tend to think we're all kind of tritheists in a way. And I don't know how that comes to us, maybe partially through misreading of the catechism, but we tend to think creation, that's God the Father's, that's in his portfolio. Jesus' job was saving our souls or forgiving our sins. Jesus' job is redemption. The Holy Spirit's job is sanctification. It's not like that at all in the Bible. It just isn't like that. John 1, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. Hebrews, God spoke to us in various ways through our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, through whom also he made the world. Jesus is involved in bringing this whole place into being. He is a creative agent. You don't know Jesus Christ if you separate him from the atoms and the stars and the moon and the planets. Jesus Christ is the one. In him, all things were created. Heaven and earth, visible, invisible, thrones, dominions, principalities, authorities. These are words that the Gnostics used to refer to rungs on the ladder. Specifically, you can go to the Gnostic literature, and these specific terms are used by them as rungs. Paul says, I don't know. Thrones, dominions, principalities, power, elemental spirits, whatever there is, it came into being through and in and for Jesus Christ. So he takes those things and throws them right back at him. He is before all things, in him all things hold together. Jesus Christ is some kind of cosmic glue. He's the head of the body, the church, the beginning, firstborn from the dead, the resurrection, that in all things he might be preeminent. There's that primacy, prototokos word again. In him all the fullness was pleased to dwell. I have in the RSV the fullness of God. I rather suspect that no matter what translation you have fullness of God. There is no manuscript evidence whatsoever for the words of God. Does not occur in any manuscript tradition.
Not in the King James.
What does it say?
That in him should all fullness dwell.
Yay, team for the King James. All right. All right.
What verse is that, Jim?
What does the New American Standard say?
It says for all fullness dwell.
All right. Beautiful. I wrote an article in Dialogue about 6-7 years ago about that one word, fullness. Of course the fullness of God dwelled in Jesus Christ. But that's not what this text says. This text says the fullness of all creation. And it is a kind of pious error or something on the part of people who have to throw of God in there because they can't quite imagine Jesus that closely connected with the birds and the bees and the trees and the rock and the animals and the sun, the moon, and the stars. It says all the fullness of everything was pleased to dwell through him to reconcile to himself all things. That word reconciliation we tend to think of as a people word. We sin against one another, we get mad at one another, so we reconcile. We get reconciled to one another. It's a people word. Here that's a thing word, neuter plural. The very stones, the rocks, the planets are reconciled to God in Jesus Christ, making peace by the blood of his cross, that crucifix and the eye opener and the telephone pole, nifty. All things, neuter plural, reconciled by the blood of the cross of Jesus Christ. A great, great passage. What Paul is saying is, if you carve down Jesus Christ to partiality, if you make him one rung on the ladder, you've really missed it. Because Jesus Christ is the one in whom and through whom and for whom all things were made, and all things are reconciled to God through the blood of his cross. Well, that has all kinds of ethical implications.
And beginning in chapter 3, there is a great then, or therefore, if then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above. There are a lot of nifty little things here. The word above is the same word that you have in John 3, where Jesus says you must be born from above, but better translated, you must be born again. It's the same word here. And I should think that if one takes the whole biblical story into account, then we would better translate something like, seek the things that God is doing in his world. Have a forward vision. Join the eschatological community. The word above is that which refers to what God is doing in his world. You have died. Your life is hid with Christ in God. Last week on Sermon on the Mount, we talked about hiddenness and visibility, all kinds of nifty stuff in here. The main thing is that the life that results from embracing Jesus Christ as the reconciler of all things is a life which is so thoroughly penetrated by Christ that you cannot describe it in terms of specific little actions that all Christians must do and that non-Christians do not do. You cannot describe the Christian life in terms of rungs on a ladder to God. The only thing you can do is say, look, it all belongs to him, it's all for him, it's all through him, it all holds together in him. Your total life belongs to God in Jesus Christ. How does that work out? Well, here are a few ways in which it might work out. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, love your husbands. Pray, give thanks. Lots of stuff in there. I like very much verse 17 of chapter 3, where Paul says, whatever you do in word or deed, and that may wind up being almost anything, but whatever you do, do everything, because all things are reconciled to God by Jesus Christ. So do all things in the name of Jesus Christ, giving thanks to God the Father through him. Nice. Colossians is, I think, a portrait of Jesus that is particularly appropriate for our time and place. I think there are all kinds of implications. Let me mention quickly three. We'll have some time for conversation. One thing it means is that no understanding of the Christian faith which separates God from common life can be authentic Christianity. It's the opposite. God is not found in the uncommon, but in the common. All things. Second implication is that if Jesus Christ is the reconciler of all things, and if you bear his name, if you're a member of his body, then of all people, you need never be lonely in this universe. It belongs to Christ. It belongs to you. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, all things are yours. Because all things are reconciled to God by the blood of Jesus Christ. And you can walk in this world with your head high and with a chuckle, because you belong here. The whole place belongs to Jesus Christ, and you belong to him. You never need to be lonely in this universe. The third implication is that if Jesus Christ is the reconciler of all things, he's the reconciler of all people and all kinds of people. You don't have to be a special kind of person to belong to him. The very rocks belong to him. You can also belong to him. He might do some exciting things with you, But you don't have to be a special kind of person. You don't have to be on rung 18 in order to belong to God in Jesus Christ. All things reconciled to God through the blood of Christ. I think that's a great, great document. And different things grab you at different times in your life. I think I'm at a stage in my life now where Colossians grabs me perhaps more than anything else. What would you like to say?
The new verse in Romans that augments what you said about all creation belonging, where it talks about all creation groaning.
Oh, yeah, right. The whole creation groans, waiting for the sons of God to come into their own. That's really an important thing to say, because there is no danger left theological statement. And every one of these portraits of Jesus is on the brink of heresy. Huh? That's true. That's why you have to, take them all together. And one of the problems, of course, in Colossians is that you're right on the edge of pantheism. Mm-hmm. Right smack up against the edge of it. And so it's very important to remember that reconciliation means that it needs reconciling. God identifies himself with the world in Jesus Christ, but that doesn't mean he is identical to the world. Okay? So, very important to say that sin is a word that describes not only my moral life, but it describes the very universe. The whole creation groans, waiting for the sons of God to come into their own. There will be a new heaven and a new earth. The earth needs fixing up. Huh? But it's fixable. You can fall into either ditch. You can say the world doesn't need fixing. It's perfect. It equals God. Or you can say the world is unfixable. I have to get out of the world in order to reach God. No. The world needs fixing, but it is fixable. And that's what we're here for, you and I. To let God work with us in fixing up his world. That's what he's doing through the church. Yeah.
This is an untested impression, Jim. But you mentioned it was 1:15 on, and that's the pretty good.
Yeah. Confessional.
Some people want to exclude that. Except in the rest, it's not being called. The untested impression was that there might be very much of a comparable, seeming to me, confessional, doxological, opposing verses of Romans 8.
Yes. Very much. I think, neither death nor life nor, yeah, right. Very much like it, and I think it's very much like 1 Corinthians 8:6. There's one Lord through whom all things were made, and one whatever it is. Yeah. No, I think it's authentically Pauline. One of the problems with the word Gnosticism is that it is used in different ways by different people. Rudolf Bultmann, for instance, who has existentialized the faith and poured it all into personal relationships, defines Gnosticism as relating God to the material universe. And so he says that 1:15 through 20 is pure Gnosticism because Paul is talking about Jesus in relationship to the stuff of creation. I think that's absolute rot. But people have excluded 1:15 through 20 for various reasons. Yeah, Ian.
It seems to me that... what you said is that because 1:15 to 26, it doesn't come from somewhere else. It seems to me that part of our hang-ups about that in modern view of literature is something you write. Yeah. Everything is original, like the person themselves is the source of everything they come from. I mean, another way of looking at creativity is what you were hinting at, taking things that come from other places and turning them a little bit and fitting... sort of progressing with ideas, one more step. And if you look at it that way, it doesn't have to be such an insult that he might have used a word from a song or a... Because these are precisely the ways in which one touches a person by using something which they're familiar with.
Right.
It seems to me it may be an important way of looking at it, that, yeah, maybe the people there already knew of this, and so that was precisely the way to grab them.
Sure, I think that's possible, and it would certainly be no insult if Paul picked up some at-hand thing and made use of it. I guess that I just think that thing is so carefully sculpted. Is that a word? It is carved so beautifully to fit precisely into that situation that... it's difficult for me to imagine that Paul didn't actually do it, but maybe not. Yeah.
You mentioned the world is fixable, and this is the job of the church. Are we succeeding? Will we reach? Will we complete the job?
I think that the Christian church says that God will complete the job. I think that it is. There is an apocalyptic strain, you know, a minor theme in the Bible that talks as though the world is unfixable. The only thing you can do is zap it and start from scratch. But the main prophetic note through Old and New Testament says that God is getting his job done, and we look forward to the time when he's going to complete it. And our job is to get in on that. I think that... you know, there are going to be lots of ups and downs, but hope is an indispensable, essential element of the Christian posture toward life. And so it seems to me that the Christian may not look out on the world with an essentially pessimistic outlook, and so we take all the data, you know, and all of that, but to say I believe that Jesus Christ lives and reigns, and I look for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come, means that I look, I am essentially hopeful. But that doesn't mean there are no problems or no discouragement.
What did you mean precisely by when it's fixed? What is the condition? What's your definition of when it's fixed?
I think that it's getting fixed up all the time. My father had surgery last Thursday, and he had two pieces of his colon taken out, and they're you know, put together again, and he's doing fine. That's fixing up the universe. God didn't make us to have those kinds of things, but sin penetrates the very fiber of our being. It penetrates the whole universe, and when God gives a surgeon that kind of skill, he's at work fixing up his world. And I thank God for that surgeon, and I thank God for that scalpel. And so maybe a dam here and a dam there, and the research that Leo is doing, and maybe nuclear reactors. There are zillions of ways in which God is at work in his world, not only preserving, not only sustaining, but fixing it up.
Well, what excites me the most of all of this, too, is that this is just for our spiritual life, and God has destroyed our hope.
Yeah.
And that's where Al is great. That's where he's a real theologian, and is right. He never loses track of that. Every promise of God, as many as there are, is the Greek, is yes in Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
You lose track of that, and then you'll do what our old Senate friends did back in 1897 when they decided that slavery was okay.
Okay, thank you very much. I guess there's coffee in the bank. All right.